What animates the world? What are the cosmic energies that underlie human experience? Americans were engaging with these questions in new and different ways in the 19th century, ways that would have significant implications in Mary Baker Eddy's life experience and in her teachings on Christian Science. In his book, Animal Spirits, The American Pursuit of Vitality, From Camp Meeting to Wall Street, Jackson Lears traces the history of an American culture fascinated with tapping into invisible sources of energy for therapeutic purposes, psychological and spiritual salvation, and even monetary gain. In Mary Baker Eddy's time, examples of these pursuits included mesmerism, hypnotism, bodily transference of electrical energy, animal magnetism, and the emergence of positive thinking techniques. Eddy knew much of this territory firsthand. She had explored it, tested it. She wrote about it, contesting its salutary and spiritual value and effect. Ultimately, she saw these practices as alien to, if not fundamentally opposed, to her discovery of Christian Science. Hello, I'm Jonathan Eder, host of Seekers and Scholars. And in this episode, we have the opportunity to learn more about the history of these practices from the author of Animal Spirits. It was published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux in 2023. It is a real pleasure to have you with us on the podcast. Welcome, Jackson Lears.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, you know, reading your book, it was just a very vital experience in and of itself, but it was alive with so many terms and so many ideas that resonated with writings from Mary Baker Eddy. It just seemed that there were these points of connection between what you were writing about in terms of the culture of the United States in Eddy's time and what it was looking for through new practices to embolden life and invigorate, and things that Mary Baker Eddy was addressing. So that's the reason you're here.
Well, I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, great, Jackson. And just a little bit more about you. You are Board of Governors Distinguished Professor of History at Rutgers University. You are editor of the journal Raritan. And there are other titles by you that have been of interest and importance to us at the Mary Baker Eddy Library to help us better understand Mary Baker Eddy's time and culture. Those include Rebirth of a Nation, The Making of Modern America, 1877 to 1920, published by HarperCollins, and No Place of Grace, Anti-Modernism and the Transformation of American Culture, 1880 to 1920, published by University of Chicago Press. So, Jackson, there is a specific area of your book that is going to be the focus of our conversation. That is the 19th and early 20th century, coinciding with Mary Baker Eddy's time. But I know the book has a wider sweep than that. So quickly, what was the initial impulse of the book, and how did you get into the subject matter?
Well, the immediate nudge for the book was the depressive effect of the business downturn in 2008, when John Maynard Keynes was revived as an economic thinker, largely because of his emphasis on animal spirits as the motivation of investors, not rational calculation, but what he called a spontaneous urge to action, which was his definition of animal spirits. So the business downturn was about economic depression, to be sure, but it was also about emotional depression.
So here we see animal spirits animating economic behavior, but where else do animal spirits take us in your book, Jackson?
There was really more to it than just its economic significance. The phrase had a long cultural history and many different meanings, and I learned that as I proceeded to get into the history of animal spirits as an idea. And there are two main meanings or themes, it seems to me, in the history of animal spirits. The first is the kind of personal meaning, that is, the link between the individual body and soul, or body and mind, which expresses itself in various forms of vitality or lack of vitality. So personal vitality is one meaning of it, one theme in the book. And the second meaning is a kind of cosmic meaning, that is, animal spirits are used to signify an energy that animates the whole universe, that vivifies rocks and trees and wolves and bears and humans, and that goes by the name, whether you happen to be an anthropologist or a religious person, a practicing Christian, or an indigenous person with your own animistic beliefs, goes by words like mana and spirit and God. And in recent centuries, there's also a tendency for what one of my students has called the religion of modernity to emerge, which is capitalism. And capital itself becomes a source of vitality and belief and strength and faith and feeling all have roles to play in the success or failure of capitalist enterprise. You can see this in the etymology of the word credit, which is rooted in credo, or I believe. It's this cosmic dimension of the subject, which is where we move from animal spirits as personal vitality to vitalism, which is a philosophical tradition that emphasizes the sources of vitality, not just in the individual, but spilling over the individual and inhabiting the larger world outside.
So interesting, Jackson. How then does this notion of vitality as emerging in the person and then connecting more broadly as energy outside the person relate to mental practices like mesmerism, hypnotism, animal magnetism?
So animal spirits spill over the boundaries of the self, permeate the cosmos as invisible sources of energy, animal magnetism, mesmerism, electricity, and a fascination with force and energy as ends in themselves become a kind of secular religion. And that's what I'm calling vitalism in the 19th century. It's the broad fascination with energy and force, often as ends in themselves, sometimes playing more modest roles as agents of individual vitality. The French philosopher Henri Bergson called it élan vital. At bottom, then, vitalism and animal spirits were amoral. And part of their dark side was that they celebrated regeneration through all kinds of means, personal and social regeneration, but in particular, among others, through violence and through war.
Jackson, it's so compelling to learn of this history and the philosophical meaning of vitalism and how that translated into this reverence for just pure energy or life force. You know, in listening to you, I couldn't help but think of Mary Baker Eddy in many contexts, but I'm thinking in particular of when she asked the question, is the universe, including man, evolved by atomic force? And this is something that students of her writings engage with at least twice a year, because it is a subject of one of the Christian Science lesson sermons addressed twice a year. For Eddy, it's a serious question. It's key in terms of whether or not one trusts in God as love or as this amoral vital force. So this is a kind of visionary question on Mary Baker Eddy's part about atomic energy. But what about these issues around vitalism, these concepts of vitalism, their expression in the 19th century?
Here's where we start to get to the connections with Christian Science and Mary Baker Eddy. In the 19th century United States, evangelical Protestants who experienced wave after wave of revival from the early 1800s on up to the 1850s and after even, and who made the conversion experience the centerpiece of those revivals. That is, that was the proof that you had been saved. And it was often a bodily and certainly an emotional experience every bit as much as a disembodied spiritual one. So evangelical conversion was experienced, as many converted Protestants said, like a wave of electricity going through the body. So electricity is being discovered at about this time. It's invisible, it's odorless, it's tasteless, but it has powerful force to it, and it has a certain element of mystery about it. So evangelical Protestants are one group that are very concerned with a kind of vitalist perspective on religious belief. The second group are on the fringes and even outside altogether from organized religion and Christianity. And they include mesmerists, clairvoyants, psychic healers. These are all people who believe that there is a force that they called animal magnetism that they could tap into and use to heal mental as well as physical disorder. And they could see into the future. They could see an invisible spiritual world that accompanied the material world. One of the most famous and influential was a man named Andrew Jackson Davis, who called himself the Poughkeepsie Seer and who managed to make a pretty good living, again, through practices of mesmerism, which later becomes hypnotism as it becomes less and less embodied. But Davis uses those forces, or claims to use them. This is true of the third group that I think is also related in the late 19th century to animal spirits and to vitalism, and that is a group that come to be known as positive thinkers. And these are contemporaries of Mary Baker Eddy's in the later 19th century.
Thank you so much, Jackson, for that overview. It gives this wonderful landscape of seeing the kind of evolution of some of these practices that are imagining a sort of force of consciousness as it melds with electricity, as it melds with these sorts of impersonal sources of energy, leading up to things that perhaps are a bit more familiar to us today, like the exercise of positive thinking.
Yes. So this period from the mid-18th century to the late 19th and early 20th centuries that is dominated in my book by evangelical Protestants, mesmerists, clairvoyants, psychic healers, and positive thinkers coincides basically with Mary Baker Eddy's biography. In fact, one could argue that this is a kind of golden age of vitalism in America, which kind of peaks in the years before World War I, this celebration of vital force, of energy, of life itself. Most of this takes place under secular and psychological therapeutic auspices. Some of it takes place under evangelical Christian auspices.
Mary Baker Eddy devotes a lot of time in her writings, Jackson, to distinguish Christian Science from some of these other practices. And I thought, if you wouldn't mind, I might just share a few of them and just see what your response would be in terms of what it helps us understand about the culture she was living in and who she was talking to in a specific way. All of her text really has a universal application as well. She writes, for example, specifically on this sort of notion of animal natures, quote, "The notion that animal natures can possibly give force to character is too absurd for consideration. When we remember that through spiritual ascendancy, our Lord and Master healed the sick, raised the dead, and commanded even the winds and waves to obey him, grace and truth are potent beyond all other means and methods." Does that strike any kind of chords for you, Jackson, when you think about the other sort of practices around animal spirits that are going on in her time?
I think her critique of animal magnetism is based largely on its animality. It's purely human quality in the sense that, you know, if any cure takes place, it's not a product of divine intervention. It's a product of the human imagination. And this, ironically, is what a lot of materialist scientists are saying at about the same time, that all of these marvelous accomplishments that are attributed to mesmerism and the manipulation of animal magnetism are really just a product of overactive human imaginations. So in that sense, she has something in common with materialist scientists.
Yeah. In her chief work, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, she does in fact have a chapter that's specifically about animal magnetism. That's titled Animal Magnetism Unmasked. And she does sort of employ the traditional medical faculty to sort of back up her perspective that animal magnetism is simply provoking the human imagination and that there's really no substance to it.
Right.
She writes in it, quote, "Mesmerism or animal magnetism was first brought into notice by Mesmer in Germany in 1775. According to the American Encyclopedia, he regarded this so-called force, which he said could be exerted by one living organism over another, as a means of alleviating disease. His propositions were as follows," and this is quoting Mesmer, "there exists a mutual influence between the celestial bodies, the earth, and animated things. Animal bodies are susceptible to the influence of this agent, disseminating itself through the substance of the nerves." And then she goes on, in 1784, the French government ordered the medical faculty of Paris to investigate Mesmer's theory and to report upon it. Under this order, a commission was appointed, and Benjamin Franklin was one of the commissioners. This commission reported to the government as follows, and this is quoting the commission. "In regard to the existence and utility of animal magnetism, we have come to the unanimous conclusions that there is no proof of the existence of the animal magnetic fluid, that the violent effects which are observed in the public practice of magnetism are due to manipulations or to the excitement of the imagination and the impressions made upon the senses, and that there is one more fact to be considered in the history of the errors of the human mind and an important experiment upon the power of the imagination." So she goes on from there and indicates that this report was adopted by the Royal Academy of Medicine in Paris. And then she says, "the author's own observations of the workings of animal magnetism convince her that it is not a remedial agent and that its effects upon those who practice it and upon their subjects who do not resist it lead to moral and to physical death," unquote. So she's upping the ante a little bit.
I'll say, yeah.
But at the same time, she's also employing the conclusions of this medical faculty to dismiss the idea that there is any kind of invisible magnetic fluid that is at work in this process.
Right. She's got science, or at least establishment science of the time on her side there. Yeah. But it's a powerful popular belief in this magnetic fluid, and that it survives on into the later 19th century, but the materiality of it becomes attenuated and it becomes somewhat more abstract and mental, so that hypnotists don't talk as much about fluid as mesmerists used to. Mm-hmm. So there is a kind of evaporation of the fluid, I guess, even in the vernacular thinking. It's harder and harder to find physical evidence of it. It's invisible, it's odorless, it's tasteless, you know, it's magic. It's like the power involved in electricity, which is also invisible and apparently limitless, which gives rise to many, many thoughts about infinite power and infinite vitality being available for human uses should we figure out how to tap into it, we humans.
So how prevalent, how popular were these practices in the United States in Mary Baker Eddy's time?
I think the practices of mesmerism and of hypnotism and of the belief in animal magnetism was widely discussed and taken seriously in the newspapers of the time, the penny press in the 1830s and 40s, and certainly more established and expensive magazines in the later 19th century. So you can find references to it everywhere. As I say, it does become a vaguer and more abstract force in the positive thinking era. It's part of a movement that's also known as New Thought. There's a flood of books and magazines telling the readers how to tap into their unused mental resources. And in some ways, it converges with popular psychoanalysis, the American style of it especially, where the unconscious is viewed as a kind of reservoir of vital energy that can be tapped into in times of need. It's all very humanist and secular, though. There is a vague spirituality about some of it, but the general tendency is to argue that these forces do not require prayer they require the individual human being's mental exercise of somehow putting himself or herself in contact with this magnetic power. There's a lot of obfuscation and a lot of obscurity in it. It's not a cleanly thought out analytical point of view, but it's pervasive in the culture, I think, well into the 20th century, and it survives into our own time.
Jackson, it's so fascinating to get that picture of both the pervasiveness, but also the lack of clarity that exists around some of these mental practices. And it helps me understand why Mary Baker Eddy felt it was so important to call these things out for what they were. It makes me think of this quote of hers. And this, again, is from Science and Health. And it reads, "God is not in the medley where matter cares for matter, where spiritism makes many gods, and hypnotism and electricity are claimed to be the agents of God's government."
I remember that quote. I actually reread some of Science and Health lately. Yes, and in fact, there's another quote from Science and Health that speaks directly to that question. She says, "No system of hygiene but Christian Science is purely mental. Before this book was published, other books were in circulation which discussed mental medicine and mind cure operating through the power of the Earth's magnetic currents to regulate life and health. Such theories have no relationship to Christian Science, which rests on the conception of God as the only life, in capitals, substance and intelligence, and excludes the human mind as a spiritual factor in the healing work." So this is about as plain as you can get in its rejection of a kind of psychotherapeutic model of religion.
So Mary Baker Eddy ultimately comes to view animal magnetism as something that's quite dangerous. And it becomes something that in her writings you see her not only distancing herself from, but also really criticizing.
Yes.
As something to be very wary of. An example of one of her writings on this would be from something called The First Church of Christ, Scientists, and Miscellany. And she writes, quote, "Animal magnetism fosters suspicious distrust where honor is due, fear where courage should be strongest, reliance where there should be avoidance, a belief in safety where there is most danger. And these miserable lies poured constantly into his mind fret and confuse it, spoiling that individual's disposition, undermining his health, and sealing his doom, unless the cause of the mischief is found out and destroyed." End of quote. When you hear a critique like that of animal magnetism, or a description of animal magnetism of that kind, is it reflective of any other thought about it that's going on in the culture at the time? Or does it really stand out as a unique position that Eddy is taking on this question of animal magnetism?
I think that in some ways she is looking here at what a lot of vitalists prefer not to look at, which is the amoral quality of a life worship. I mean, if you're just worshiping the life force, worshiping energy as an end in itself, or spontaneous action as an end in itself, then it would be possible to get yourself started on the slippery slope to fascism, which is a kind of secular religion of action, of manly action, of regeneration through violence. She refers at one point to the victims of animal magnetism losing their individuality and lending themselves as willing tools to carry out the designs of their worst enemies, even those who would induce their self-destruction. I mean, it's ahistorical, but one could see her gesturing here or predicting, at least anticipating the great dictators of the mid-20th century and their capacity to whip up through animal magnetism, the animal magnetism of their speaking style and their behavior. Mussolini was a vitalist hero in even in America for a while before the nature of fascism in Italy became widely known in the 1930s. But for some time before then, he was a figure of pure act, pure action. And that notion of pure act also applied to Theodore Roosevelt, the American president who was a good liberal and respected balance of power and, you know, restraints on executive action and so on. But he also celebrated action and vitality as ends in themselves. And he particularly celebrated military action. So it's as if Eddie anticipated and presciently the shortcomings of animal magnetism as a force for healing, and saw it as in some ways just the reverse. Now, I don't agree that it was exclusively evil in its effects by any means, and I think that, you know, there's a lot to be said for animal spirits in many forms, and I try to say it in my book, but I think she does capture the dark side here. And it reminds me a little bit of William James, who says, what we need is a moral equivalent of war, one that can spur us to heroic deeds, a spontaneous impulse to action, as Keynes would say, that's dedicated toward humane ends and not towards destruction.
You know, what you were just saying, Jackson, it makes me think of this marginal note where Mary Baker Eddy sort of places just a couple of words at the side of her text in Science and Health. And that marginal note reads, Christian warfare. And it relates to this sentence, quote, there is too much animal courage in society and not sufficient moral courage.
I think that's a great line. I like that. And I think it still applies in many ways to public discussion of war making. In fact, I had a professor in college who made that distinction about the importance to understand the difference between physical courage and moral courage. And it's stuck with me ever since. And it's only quite recently, since I've been in touch with you, that I realized Mary Baker Eddy said the same thing.
Well, Jackson, you are an intellectual historian. So with that in mind, who are some of the thinkers, writers in Mary Baker Eddy's time who most explicitly addressed this question of the tension between or the choice between reverencing material energy versus spiritual energy?
But the ablest and most profound thinker on this subject was Henry Adams, who was fascinated in his later career, especially by energy and force. He was fascinated by the kind of energy embodied in the Virgin Mary, the Queen of Heaven, at Chartres Cathedral and in the center of medieval Christianity. But he was also fascinated by what he saw as the modern embodiment of energy, which in a sense portended a kind of secular religion of energy and force, and that was the dynamo. He visited the halls of dynamos at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893 and again in Paris in 1900, and as he said, reflecting on the dynamo, before the end, one began to pray to it. So there is definitely a sense of the sacred about this energy, but it wasn't the same kind of energy that provided nurturance, spiritual nurturance and hope and love, as the Virgin Mary did for medieval Catholics. It was an abstract power, apparently limitless, and therefore somewhat frightening as well as also awe-inspiring.
So I have to quote from Eddie in response to that, because I believe his, maybe the subchapter was titled The Dynamo and the Virgin. Is that right?
In Henry Adams' autobiography.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. So it makes me think of this quote from Eddie. She writes, quote, the son of the Virgin Mother unfolded the remedy for Adam or error. And the Apostle Paul explains this warfare between the idea of divine power, which Jesus presented, and mythological material intelligence called energy, italicized, and opposed to spirit.
Good, good.
Well, it's been fascinating going over some of this territory with you, Jackson. Eddy writes a lot using the kind of language of vitalism, but she adopts it to her deeply Christian approach to healing, Christian approach to outreach to her fellow humans.
Yes.
And I think this kind of captures it best. She writes, quote, "Let us feel the divine energy of spirit, bringing us into newness of life and recognizing no mortal nor material power is able to destroy. Let us rejoice that we are subject to the divine powers that be. Such is the true science of being. Any other theory of life or God is delusive and mythological."
Yeah, I think that's very powerful. In a time when religion is constantly threatening to turn into therapy, and I'm not saying that that impulse is wholly wrong. I mean, I think there can be therapeutic dimensions of religious belief and should be recognized as such, but there is a kind of heroic affirmation of divine supremacy over human beings there.
Well, it's been energizing talking with you, Jackson. And for us here at the Mary Baker Eddy Library, it is so interesting to get a better understanding of the cultural surround for Mary Baker Eddy and to understand why she would have chosen the kind of language she did.
Yes.
So to get a little bit more insight into that, we're very grateful. So thanks so much, Jackson.
It's been my pleasure, and I learned a lot, too, from you guys. So thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode on Mary Baker Eddy's argument with animal magnetism and vitalism. It's always meaningful for us at Seekers and Scholars to talk with authors who have researched into the kinds of practices and issues that were going on in the 19th and early 20th century, issues that were of importance to Mary Baker Eddy and about which she wrote. In the episode, we discussed Eddy's chapter on animal magnetism unmasked in her chief work, Science and Health, with Key to the Scriptures. It's a relatively short chapter, about 7 pages or so. If you'd like to read it online, you can find it under the header Publications and Activities on the website called christianscience.com. Also, as an audio consumer, you might enjoy accessing the audiobook of Science and Health, which you can also find on the christianscience.com website through its online shop. Upcoming episodes will include looking at the concept of what a library means for a church, in which we will be showcasing how the Mary Baker Eddy Library's collections act as a resource for different departments at the headquarters of the Christian Science Church in their work and in their global outreach. I'm Jonathan Eder. Thank you for listening to Seekers and Scholars.
This podcast is produced by the Mary Baker Eddy Library in Boston, Massachusetts, USA. Copyright 2024.